This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the fine line between a terrible act and terrorism. But first, as fighting in Yemen intensifies, many are now wondering what lies ahead for a country that's engaged in what some call a proxy war. Perhaps even more baffling is what's driving this violence in the first place.
This is treated as a sectarian battle between Iran-backed Shia and Saudi Arabia-backed Sunnis. But really, when you look at the essence of Yemen's problem, that's not really it. You have plenty of Yemeni Sunnis who are siding with the Houthis in this case. Particularly, you have branches of the Yemeni military that are largely Sunni that are fighting on the side of the Houthis. And when you look at why the Houthis have gained this support, it's largely due to non-religious issues. And I think it's also important to remember that Yemen is not a country with a huge history of sectarianism.
That's Adam Barron of the European Council on Foreign Relations in a recent interview with Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep. Today we're going to take a closer look at the many forces involved in Yemen's civil war with the former ambassador there. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Mark Hambly joins me. He is, again, the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. He's the former ambassador to Lebanon and Qatar. He served in Yemen in the 1970s. And it's good to have you here, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. I was not ambassador in Yemen, though, I'm afraid.
Oh, no. I apologize for that. But you know the country well. I guess I'm first like to ask you, before we get into some specifics about what you know about this country, which America has paid so little attention to over the years, if you feel as though the analysis that we got on Morning Edition is largely right, that we are saying that this is a sectarian battle there, and perhaps a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, but that's not the right way to look at it. How do you see this?
Well, I think it is a bit of an exaggeration to call it a sectarian conflict. It's a conflict which goes back, has roots back many, many decades. In the first place, the one has to discuss who are the Houthis, what are they, and what they are not. And what they are is that they're a revivalist group amongst the Zaydi Muslims. Zaydi Muslims are a moderate form of Shiite Islam, unlike the Iranian version, which is much more extreme, much more focused on aspects of Islam which are not agreed to by the Zaydis. The Zaydis, though, have a belief in which they find a much more modern approach to Islam. They believe university education is important, for example. They believe in the importance of taking the hadith of the Prophet Muhammad into a broader context. In other words, it's not set in iron. They look at it in terms of modern context. But where you have a difference is that you have in Yemen a population which is largely Shafi, which are Sunnis, and Zaydis, who are about 30% of the population, and are these moderate Shiites. What happened was for about 1,000 years, Yemen was controlled by the Zaydis through an emirate, which was the ruling sort of royal government until 1962 when there was a revolt. Following that, you had a Republican government which came into power after the Civil War, which was supported by various parties around the world. But what I think is important to take in mind is that the Saudis now have a situation where they look at it from two prisms. First one being domestically, they have a new new government in office. The king has only been in office about 3 months. A new defense minister, very young man. He has to prove himself with his constituency. And so they have to look at a way in which they can develop a national position, shows his strength as a good defense minister. Then they look at what's going on in Yemen. The Houthis are a group which has responded negatively to Saudi Arabia's efforts to induce a Wahhabi type of Salafism into Yemen, which is not in the Yemeni context. So this is one of the problems where it comes into sort of sectarian view, that it's between the Houthis being Shiites and the Saudis being very conservative Muslims.
The Saudi influence here and the Saudi take on this conflict, the reason they are so involved, is it because of wanting to exert influence in this country which has been struggling to find its foothold, or is it about protecting their own national interests right next door?
Well, I think it's basically a mixture of both. Traditionally, the Saudis have had a position that they've had long border problems with the Yemen. These were supposedly resolved in a treaty in 2000, but still there's a lot of cross-border smuggling of everything from arms to alcohol to even women and children. The al-Qaeda, which was very active in Saudi Arabia in the first part of this century, what large of those arms the Saudis accused came from Yemen. And then when they were defeated in Saudi Arabia, they went back to Yemen, many of the supporters from Saudi Arabia. So you have al-Qaeda as well, based down in Yemen. The Houthis, again, because one of the reasons they developed this revival movement was in response to the Saudi effort to bring in a Salafist Sunni version of Islam, Wahhabi Salafism into Yemen, which the Zaydis thought was wrong. That's not in their tradition. So the Saudis look at Yemen as being supported by the Iranians. This is something which is not really totally correct. Although there are certainly amount of assistance which comes from Iran for the Houthis, the Saudis are presenting as being an Iranian proxy. They look at Iran moving into Iraq, into Syria, supporting Bashar al-Assad very strongly, supporting Haider al-Abadi in Iraq very strongly. These are Shiite governments. The Saudis strongly do not like Iran in their neighborhood, and they now see themselves being encircled by what they view as being the Iranian presence down in Yemen as represented by the Houthis. That is not really correct. It's more of a effort on their part to convince the Saudi people this is why they're fighting down in Yemen, or to get rid of the Iranians. But in fact, I think there's very little evidence that there's direct Iranian Iranian presence in Yemen, and very little support's coming in as well.
We're talking today with Mark Hambly, who's a former U.S. ambassador. He was the consul general in Yemen in the 1970s and former ambassador to Lebanon and Qatar. He joins us here to give us a bit of information about a country that we spend little time talking about here in the United States but has big political implications. Of course, in those political implications, the involvement of Iran in this, obviously, the long-time rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran has some sectarian pieces to it, but it also has an awful lot to do with politics of the region. Iran right now seemingly working with the United States and other countries on a nuclear treaty. Iran also working with the United States to try to combat ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And, of course, the Saudis, a longtime U.S. ally. What's the U.S. role in all this, specifically in Yemen? Because it does seem to put us in a complicated position.
It does put us in a very complicated position. We have been in Yemen for the past, our most recent interface with the Yemeni government has been as a counterterrorism effort against al-Qaeda, which is a very strong franchise in Yemen. It's a franchise which had direct implications on U.S. security. In October 2000, they attacked the USS Cole in Aden Harbor. 17 U.S. sailors were killed during that attack. They had one of the masterminds behind 9/11 was from Yemen. We had Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen of Yemeni origin, was, of course, based in Yemen for a number of years and recruited many people, including the bomber for the Nigerian bomber for the that aircraft, the Delta over Detroit a few years ago, the Fort Hood assassin. And, of course, he was removed by a drone attack by the U.S. government on a very controversial but probably necessary move a few years ago. So our focus with Yemen has been on trying to eliminate al-Qaeda from being a threat to us. That's why instability in Yemen is such a big issue for us. The Saudis, well, of course, do not like al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is strongly opposed to the Saudi government as well. But the Houthis as well do not like al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda considers them as being apostate, as being non-Islamic, because they have a Shiite origin. So there's a constant friction there as well. And so the Saudis, when, now are against ISIS. But ISIS, if you look at their ideology, frankly, there are many commonalities between ISIS ideology and the Wahhabi ideology at their base. They're both Salafist groups, but both of them have different views as to the legitimacy of governments in power. The Houthis, on the other hand, don't like Salafis because they think they are impeding and endear against Yemeni basic culture and identity. And so that's what you have a strain there, which is a bit difficult.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, though, that you talked about that we, again, maybe don't think often enough about when we consider warring groups is this idea that the Houthis represent a type of strain of modern Shiism. And modernity versus a sort of ancient outlook is one of the big issues that we're facing. The idea that ISIS has in this region of trying to reclaim some sort of an ancient caliphate versus nation states like Bashar al-Assad, obviously very modern, very brutal in his own way. Is that part of the conflict really, Mark, a battle between modernity in some ways and some sort of ancient view of Islam in your mind?
I think it's drawn from individuals who find themselves without power in society, without jobs. They look for new solutions. Look for those solutions in terms of religion, in terms of Islam. And they look, you have these prelates who come up and say that the problem with modern society is it's become corrupt. This is why they want to see, you know, on one hand, you have in modern Sunni Islam, you have sort of two strains. One, you have the Muslim Brotherhood, who believes that you you can change society through a political engagement. But it's a very radical engagement, but through politics. Then you have the Salafists, who say that, no, we should reject that political engagement because society is corrupt. We can go back to our roots, which was Islam under the Prophet Muhammad's time, and develop society which is based on the Sharia. But then you have groups which then move out of these groups, pick out of the Salafis, and become more radicalized. And they see that, well, let's just allow things sort of to go on in their own natural course. We have to go in and intervene in a way which removes the cancer from society.
Mm. I have to ask you a last question before we run low on time. Obviously, when you served in this country in Yemen back in the 1970s, things were probably quite a bit different there. As you look back on the way, whether it's the United States or the world has approached countries like this or some of the things that have happened, can you look back and say, here is one or two things that we could have done differently or could have happened differently to make for a better, rosier outcome for a country like Yemen today?
I think the problem with countries like Yemen is that we did not find ways which we could broaden civil society in order to have them develop mechanisms where they would become participants in their own political future. In Yemen, as in many countries, you had a ruler of Abdel Saleh who took over in 1979 after the murder of his predecessor, who was murdered by South the Yemeni agents. Abdel Saleh was in power until 2011. Over time, he developed a more liberal policy. Political parties were formed. There was actually an election in 1991, which had multiple parties joining into a parliament. But that said, the society as a whole, frankly, was a very repressed society. He ruled. He got a lot of money from the Saudis in order to develop patronages. But Al Qaeda came in, took root, so he used a lot of that money to fight them. And then the Houthis came in too, because they like Abdullah Saleh, because what they saw as someone who was not developing the country in which was proper. So he had launched six wars against them. Mm. And now you have things sort of shifting around again, and you have different players sort of going back and making new alliances, which is very typical of the Middle East. But what we should have done, I think, frankly, all these societies, be it Egypt, even in Saudi Arabia, we should probably try to encourage civil society more to try to develop mechanisms where people can empower themselves and support those efforts when they come forward. But that we have not done very successfully.
Mm. Mark Hamley is a former U.S. ambassador who joined us today to talk a bit about a country he knows well, Yemen. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
And I want to thank our friends at the World Affairs Council of Connecticut for helping us with today's program. Coming up next on the show, we're going to take a closer look at the fine line between a terrible act and terrorism. Our conversation continues online at WNPR.org. This is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tonight, I hope you can join Where We Live's executive producer, Katie Talarski, as she presents The Ear Cave, her regular listening session where public radio fans and professionals get together and listen to the best in radio storytelling. It's happening tonight at 7 p.m. at the Carriage House Theater in Hartford, home of the Heartbeat Ensemble. It kicks off a week-long storytelling series in locations around Hartford. It's called The Thread. There's a lot of really great storytelling throughout this week. For more information, go to our Where We Live Facebook page. Hope you can join us. In what can only be seen as the cruelest of coincidences, the likely intentional downing of a Germanwings plane in the French Alps and the horrifying attack on a college campus in Kenya took a very similar toll in lives lost. But in so many ways, these stories are very, very different. Nobody disputes that the gruesome killings of students by the militant group Al-Shabaab was an act of terrorism. There's also almost universal acceptance that the act of a single, possibly depressed German pilot was not terrorism. But why not? What exactly defines terrorism today? If a plane, which was also full of young students, crashes, prompting international fear, policy changes, and a wholesale review of the airline industry, isn't that terrorism? If the pilot had, with everything else being exactly the same, a different last name or a different religion, would it matter? For that matter, when we consider Tim McVeigh or Adam Lanza or Ted Kaczynski, why do we not immediately think terrorist? But we do when it comes to the attempted shoe bomber we mentioned earlier. So what is terrorism? You can join us, 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WNPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining me in studio is Vesna Markovic, who's assistant professor and assistant dean at the University of New Haven's Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Science. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good morning.
Also joining me in studio is Timur Yuskayev, who's assistant professor of contemporary Islam at Hartford Seminary. He's co-editor of the Muslim World Journal. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Vesna, I'm going to start with you. What is the commonly held definition of terrorism today?
Unfortunately, there isn't a common definition, which kind of is part of the problem. If you look at different organizations, different agencies, they have different definitions. So you can look at State Department, you can look at FBI definition, you can look at UN definition. So there are many different definitions and none of them are the same. And that's part of the problem. They have some common characteristics, so targeting civilian populations or noncombatants. And in doing so, it's to intimidate either a population or to coerce government or some political ideology or some trying to implement some social change. So those are some common themes or threads for definitions of terrorism, but there isn't one definition.
Do you think that we need one in order to not only prosecute crimes, but in order to make good decisions as a society? Do you think we need a very clear definition of what terrorism is?
I think there needs to be a uniform definition. And unfortunately, for example, the UN has been having issues because you can't get all the member states to agree to a definition, and therefore combating and coming up with policies makes it very difficult to do so.
And of course, what happens is that we then open up the conversation to a political dialogue, which allows us to have the President of the United States or someone on the ground at the FBI say almost immediately in any particular case, this is or this is not terrorism. And we're going to be talking specifically about the Germanwings crash a little bit in a moment. But there are so many terrible things that happen in the world each day, frankly. And when we hear about those things, one of the very first questions that's asked at the next press conference is, was this an act of terrorism? And that gives whoever the political operative is on the ground an opportunity to cast it in one way or another. Because we don't have a specific definition, it really then becomes a very, very political term, probably much more so than it should be, right?
Well, you can look at some cases. For example, the 2013 Nidal Hassan attack at Fort Hood. Initially, after that came out, it was classified as workplace violence, and it took 2 years. Just in 2015, they signed a National Defense Authorization Act to allow the soldiers that died in that attack to get a Purple Heart because it wasn't classified as terrorism. It was classified as workplace violence. And so there are many different examples when it comes to whether something is terrorism or not. There was information that Nidal Hassan actually contacted and was in contact with Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the religious emir for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which operates out of Yemen. And so, should it be classified as terrorism? Should it be classified as workplace violence? And so that was a big discussion right after that event.
And I'd like to turn to you, Timur Yuskayev, because I think that example is actually about as good an example as we can possibly have when we talk about this. It raises the specter of, is terrorism in 2015 by definition something that has to do with Islamic extremism? Is that the only thing that we call terrorism today?
No, not officially. If you look at the official documents coming from official organizations, such as the Europol has a commission that deals with terrorism. They classify various forms of terrorism. They do not even talk about Islamic terrorism per se, but they talk about religiously inspired terrorism, and they include other religious groups there as well. So it not necessarily, when it comes to popular discourse, however, it is likely the case. It is likely the case that post 9/11, our discourses have changed. The way we talk about terrorism has changed. And when it comes to acts of terrorism, when the question is raised, is it terrorism? One of the questions at the back of the mind for many people is, who are the perpetrators? Have they been influenced by an Islamic ideology? And that would make it a terrorism for some. So Nidal Hassan's case is one of those. Nidal Hassan, some would argue, was mentally unstable. So is mental instability a factor in his crime, right? Is that the defining factor, or is it the fact that he communicated with a very dangerous individual in Yemen? And, of course, it can be both, right?
It can be both. And it one of the reasons we're having this conversation today, frankly, is a series of conversations I've been having in the newsroom and with other people about the aftermath of the Germanwings crash, in which it was almost immediately said by every official on the ground, well, we can definitively say this was not an act of terrorism. And that allowed us to rule out a bunch of things that we might immediately go to, that someone brought down this plane through some technique, that one of the multinational terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS had something to do with it. So we rule those things out. But it got me thinking, actually, very much about something you just mentioned there. It's about mental instability. It seems quite clear that the pilot that allegedly brought this plane down intentionally had some mental problems of some sort. We don't know anything, really, about the mental state of the many hundreds of people who we have classified as terrorism over the years, whether or not that's someone who's strapped on a vest and blown himself up in Israel, or someone who flew a plane into the World Trade Center towers. How much should that matter, the mental state of someone who commits a terrible act?
It should matter. It's a part of the equation, right? So no act committed by anybody is influenced by one single reason. So one has to look at the variety of reasons. The problem with the word terrorism is useful. One of its uses is that it overrides investigations into other potential motives, into other potential reasons. One of the things that we are forgetting is that the word terrorism has changed, the way it has been used has changed throughout the last two centuries. At first, it was applied to specifically a state policy. The word terrorism comes from the era of the French Republic. And it is only at the end of the 19th century that the common sense perception of terrorism as a tool of individuals and non-state actors emerges. And that has become kind of our standard way of looking at terrorism. And the way we actually talk about terrorism changes decade after decade, it seems. So the affiliation of Islam specifically with terrorism is a very recent phenomenon. It emerges in the 1990s. Until 1990s, many of the cases of terrorism were affiliated with anarchist groups, Marxist groups, and so forth and so on. Also, the way we talk about terrorism down the road may change as well.
We're talking today with Tim Maryuskayev, who is from the Hartford Seminary, Vesna Markovic, who is from the University of New Haven. And we're talking today about terrorism, what exactly it means in society today, and how those definitions are changing all the time. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, or you can join us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Vesna, did you want to jump in on that question, that thought?
Well, I mean, it has changed, but if you look at terrorism, and I agree, starting in the 80s and 90s, there was that shift. And so the UN had a definition of terrorism that's kind of similar to what we're seeing today, and that was in 1994. You have to remember we had the first World Trade Center bombing in 93. We had the Oklahoma City bombing, which Timothy McVeigh is definitely considered a terrorist, 1995. Khobar Towers targeting Aramco Oil in 96. Embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 98. USS Cole in 2000. So there were a lot of things leading up to September 11th. So September 11th was a watershed moment, but that really changed law enforcement's what they're going after, what their funding is focused on.
Of course, the McVeigh instance, indeed, people now believe that this was a terrorist act, but we think about so-called domestic terrorism very differently, and the United States does not have a long history of what we call domestic terrorism. Frankly, before 9/11, we didn't have a long history of terrorist acts at all coming from the outside on our soil. Is there some way in which the McVeigh case is different, either in the public perception, the way the case was prosecuted, or the way that we think about it now these many years later?
Well, there were actually terrorist attacks in the U.S. from outside. You look at some of the Cuban dissidents and some of the Puerto Rican groups in the 70s and early 80s, and then we had domestic groups like the Weather Underground. So, I mean, there were cases, you know, prior to Timothy McVeigh. But yeah, that was definitely a major case. And it was looked at a little bit differently because he was, you know, a U.S. citizen who carried out one of the most major attacks at that time. And so it was looked at a little bit differently. And I don't think that the prosecution of the case made a difference, because once you look at what terrorism is, you know, it's almost like Justice Stevens talking about pornography, saying, I don't know what the definition is, but I know it when I see it.
You know when you see it, but who you are has an awful lot to do with it. And I think that the perceptions of the majority Caucasian American, Christian American public probably views who a terrorist is quite a bit different than the rest of the world does. Do you have a thought?
There is a long history of terrorism as a tactic of terrorizing population for political purposes. So there are all sorts of definitions of terrorism. One common denominator is politics. So terrorism is about politics. And there has been a long history of terrorism in the United States. You should not forget that a U.S. president, William McKinley, was assassinated by a terrorist, by an anarchist terrorist, who was a Polish-American. What is interesting is that in the early 19th century, terrorism as a phenomenon was associated in the popular press and so forth with so-called hyphenated Americans, with people who were immigrants, first to second generation, who were perceived as importing a violent ideology from Europe. So Polish immigrants, Jewish immigrants, Russian immigrants, Hungarian immigrants, Bosnian immigrants, Serbian immigrants, and so forth, right? What we are seeing today when it comes to specifically the Muslim American community is almost a replay of that scenario, where you have a newer generation of immigrants who are being assimilated into the society under the suspicion of being affiliated with an ideology of terrorism. It is not new. So the good news that it is not new, that it will pass. The bad news that is happening right now to our fellow Americans.
Another example, of course, is the ongoing trial in Boston of the Boston Marathon bomber, now the admitted Boston Marathon bomber, Zhahar Tsarnaev. I'm wondering, Vesna, how you feel this case may either be a watershed moment in the way that we think about terrorism, or maybe something that just goes along in the same narrative that the Timor was just talking about. Here is someone who, essentially, his defense lawyers are saying he was under the spell of an older brother who had been, in their words, radicalized, and he wasn't acting so much out of his own ideology, but more as a supporting character. As we think about the definitions of terrorism and how we react to it, what is new or different about this case?
Well, when you look at the instance compared to, let's say, first World Trade Center bombing or to September 11th, you know, you have people who are coming from abroad to carry out attacks in the U.S., whereas Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlan came to the U.S. when they were fairly young. So they pretty much grew up here and therefore would have been radicalized here. So that's kind of where the difference is in this idea of homegrown terrorism or these lone wolf terrorists. So that's kind of where it's shifting, especially when you see all the events happening around the world, like the one in Australia at the Lindt Cafe, Charlie Hebdo in Paris, the attacks recently in Tunisia and at the museum. And so those are the things that people are worried about rather than some other type of event. When you look at what they're probably more likely to be victimized by, it's fraud or, you know, the Ken Lays of the world, if you would, Enron. But people aren't afraid of that walking down the street. They're more afraid of, you know, these incidents such as the Boston bombing.
And what I would think worries many people in the Muslim community, Timur, is the sense that whether or not it's after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris or some incidents that have happened in England or certainly this in the United States, that when you talk about homegrown terrorism, that it shines a bright light on the community of Muslim Americans, French Muslims, that can only be seen, frankly, as somewhat destructive. Often it is very racist in the way it's viewed. We turn our gaze after an attack like this to the community at large in seemingly a fairly unfair way.
That is true. Let me just I want to zero in on a couple of things that
yes.
Vesna just said. One is and Eugene. One is there is another phenomenon in the United States that has long roots, which can be classified as terrorism, and we constantly overlook as we look back at our history, and that is lynching. Lynching was a strategy of terrorizing a population, right? So terrorism as a phenomenon is not new. Now, the other thing that Vesna has said about specifically the Boston Marathon bombers was the word here. So they were radicalized here. But in the age of the internet, what is here?
Here's every place, right?
Exactly. And here you have two individuals who were avid consumers of internet propaganda and carrying within them the feelings of injustice, the feelings of hurt, that are really connected to the histories of their families back in Russia. Let us not forget the Chechen. And the Chechen people have gone through decades of horrible oppression, and in the 1990s and early 2000s, horrible war. So these gentlemen were radicalized probably through that history, and it has become, they have probably resided in this echo chamber of the internet propaganda. And one of the figures that has resided in a similar kind of echo chamber was Anders Breivik, the gentleman who is the Norwegian terrorist who killed 77 people in Norway in, I think, 2012. The interesting thing about him is that he was targeting, his target were Muslims, but the people he killed were not. He's actually specifically selected the people to target as multiculturalist, Marxist people who were making supposedly the transformation of Europe into an Islamic territory easier. And here was a case of a right-wing terrorist who got his ideology on the internet as well.
Mm. But the Breivik case, there's a perfect example of the Vesna. An instance where the world perhaps does not immediately jump to the word terrorism in the same way it might elsewhere, in part because it was seen as a horrible mass shooting, which then prompted in many ways of the similar type of shooting that happened right here in Connecticut. Adam Lanza studied Anders Breivik. I mean, so in its way, while no one says truly that that Adam Lanza was a terrorist, he seems to have been, for lack of a better word, radicalized by a type of action that Timur says was indeed terrorism.
Well, you know, those are two separate cases. Obviously, the Adam Lanza, yeah, people weren't jumping on to say that's terrorism and it's not. But, you know, it when you go back and you look at the reason why somebody did it, and you brought up earlier mental health as well as an issue, and, you know, it depends on what the purpose of the attack was. And so the guy in Norway, he left a manifesto behind, and so that kind of led that to be labeled as terrorism. So, for example, if the German Wings pilot had left some manifesto behind, that would probably be an easier reason to classify that as terrorism.
The lack of a manifesto, truly. I mean, Ted Kaczynski had a manifesto, and he was by all counts a domestic terrorist, but not in the same way we view or prosecute or go after terrorism in all these other cases, specifically of Islamic extremism.
Well, he wasn't considered at that time. You know, the definitions were talking about groups and groups of individuals. And so the Unabomber, although he did terrorize and by today's standards would be considered a terrorist at that time, wasn't just because of the nature of, you know, acting alone, even though he did have a political ideology. And so he was caught in, I think it was 1996. So that was after the first World Trade Center bombing had already occurred. So that was kind of on the cusp. Had it happened a little bit later on, he definitely would have been classified more as a terrorist than not.
Did you have a quick thought before our break?
one thing to keep in mind, and I think Vesna has mentioned it before, is that one of the effects of the word terrorism is that it induces panic. And panic is not conducive to sober, rational thinking. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the acts of terrorism are rare. When it comes to specifically people who happen to be Muslim in the United States, those acts are extremely rare. There is a center affiliated with Duke University called Triangle Center of Terrorism and Homeland Security. They every year they issue reports on the acts of terrorism plotted or committed by Muslim Americans, and those numbers the trend has been since 9/11 minuscule. So, for example, last year there were 26 cases of individuals who were somehow arrested in acts related to terrorism, not committing terrorism, but acts related to terrorism. Within the same period of time, there were 30 mass shootings in the United States.
We're talking today about terrorism and what exactly it is, what our definition is today. When we come back, we're going to talk more about why the language itself matters. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can also find us online on Twitter and Facebook at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the CDC says 1 in 68 Americans has autism spectrum disorder. New children are diagnosed each year, but finding a cure remains out of reach, leaving early intervention and access to treatment our best hopes for right now. We're going to talk a bit about autism, including whether Connecticut's making it too hard for those who need treatment to get it. Hope you can join our conversation. Today on the program, we're trying to define what terrorism means today. We're joined by Vesna Markovic, who's assistant professor and assistant dean at the University of New Haven's Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Science. Timur Yuskayev is assistant professor of contemporary Islam at Hartford Seminary. They have joined us in studio today. Joining me by phone now is Laura Beth Nielsen, who's professor of sociology and director of the Center for Legal Studies at Northwestern University. Thank you, Laura Beth, for joining us. I truly appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you.
First of all, you've been listening to some of our conversation. I'll ask you first, why do you think the definition of terrorism actually matters? We seem to be skirting around whether or not we have a solid definition of it. Why do you think the word itself matters?
Well, it matters for a lot of reasons. First, of course, we have to have a precise definition if we're going to be able to prosecute these crimes. We need to have the kinds of definitions that prosecutors are able to talk to juries about that are understandable and precise. But more broadly, I think the word matters because when it's first invoked after an incident, when we don't know very much about it, it captures the possibilities of where we might go for understanding what that event was. So, for example, in the German Wings air crash, the question of, you know, is this an act of something akin to war? Is this something that's a criminal act? Is this something that's done by somebody who's mentally ill? And so when it gets talked about at sort of at the breaking news moment, it affects how people understand what the appropriate actions for the state are going forward. And that has obviously big implications for civil liberties and civil rights.
As a matter of fact, I'm casting back my memory to the day of the Boston Marathon bombing as we were listening to the coverage of WBUR there, the ongoing terror that happened that day, and of course the aftermath of this. We on our air, NPR did certainly, we spent quite a bit of time talking about Chechnya in a way that we wouldn't have had the people involved not been found to be from a specific place. And that's an important thing you say, Laura Beth, that the initial reaction to this is very important in the way we chase down the story and what we choose to, frankly, be terrified of.
Exactly. And a lot of times what we're doing is looking backwards for clues, and we're looking quickly for clues. And that can lead us to make determinations based on race, based on last name, based on religious affiliation, that simply aren't the kinds of criteria for decision making about how we want to investigate and prosecute people, right? We consider them illegitimate criteria. They might be useful in the first moments for law enforcement to begin to understand what they're actually looking at, but for us as a public, it can create biases and unnecessary fears and a sense that, you know, all bad things are due to this one group or this kind of people.
Obviously, our propensity to jump to a conclusion, whether it's in the media or just in society today, is something that impacts us negatively in a lot of different ways. But when it comes to an actual definition, Laura Beth Nielsen, do you think that if we had a more clear-cut definition, it would help us understand the world a little bit better? It would help us sort of form opinions and form ways of attacking some of the problems that we have out there? Are we hamstrung, in fact, by the fact that we have such imprecise language around this very important thing?
I think it does. I think the big thing that's missing in the German wings crash and why it was very quickly, you know, sort of not terrorism, is there's no demand. We think of terrorism as involving, or one of the crucial components, as your earlier guests were saying, that's shared among the different definitions, is that there's a demand, right? U.S. out of Middle East, U.K. out of Ireland, let the Basque region be separate from Spain. And when we don't immediately have a sense that there is a demand associated with it, we feel pretty clearly like it's not terrorism. Whereas it's the idea that there's a group of people who are going to continue the violence until this demand is met, right? So if the terrorist dies in the attack, if it's a suicide attack, what the difference is with terrorism, the idea that they're connected to a group that's going to continue this violence until the demand is met. And so we need to be terrorized, right? We need to be afraid to get on a plane or go to a grocery store or go to the embassy in Kenya.
This idea of a demand, Vesna, though, it leads us into another one of the tricky complications here, which is when someone's making a demand, it may just be because they want to terrorize and they want to kill the other. But it may very well be because they believe they have a righteous fight on their hands. They are trying to accomplish something that the rest of the world does not understand how important it is to them. And when we either mention, as Laura Beth did, the IRA, or we talk about Chechnya, a freedom fighter to someone is a terrorist to someone else. Vesna, how do we parse that out?
Well, that's part of the problem in coming up with a definition, especially when you're looking at United Nations and all the member states. You do have regional conflicts that are going on, and they don't want to pigeonhole themselves where they get into issues in their own country. So that's part of the problem with defining terrorism. The other problem that I see is that it's not just defining. Even if we came up with a definition of terrorism that's pretty uniform, you know, you have the internet, you have media, you still have people that are going to release stories that, is this terrorism? We want to find out right away, because you don't have for example, in the German Wings case, you didn't have all the information right up front. You have to wait till there's some type of investigation to say, okay, the plane was downed, you know, that it was downed and not a mechanical failure. And so then you have to go back and see, was there some type of political demand? But, you know, everybody wants to get the story out immediately, so you start speculating, and that's where we would come into a problem anyway, whether you had a definition of terrorism that was uniform or not.
Does that, Timur, does this idea of the demand have some bearing on your view of this? The sense that, for instance, as we talk about ISIS, most in the world see their claim as illegitimate, of reestablishing a type of caliphate that most Muslims do not even agree with, versus some small group that considers that a country needs to get out of their territory. They see themselves as freedom fighters. They might have a legitimate claim. Is legitimacy of the claim or the demand maybe part of the definition?
It's a tough question. One thing before getting to that, I want to say is that while there may not be one definition of terrorism, there are many good books on terrorism. One of those is Bruce Hoffman's Inside Terrorism, which provides a good history of terrorism as a tactic. So one should not forget that terrorism is a tactic. One of the initial impetuses behind it is a tactic of what is called propaganda by the deed. So it is through the deed of terrorizing a population that a message is being delivered. When we look into different places in the world where the terrorism as a tactic is being employed, one must not mistake the tactic for other denominators in that story. So ISIS is a specific story in a specific region, which comes out of specific situations. ISIS would not have happened had the state of Iraq not been destroyed. And out of that anarchy came out an anarchist organization. ISIS is an anarchist Muslim organization which thrives on anarchy. So whatever their claims at legitimacy, they come out of that horrible environment of disorder, where they take on grievances that are real, but they express them in a way that is also quite cultist. So if we are look at ISIS, to look at them just as terrorists would not explain the whole story. Looking at them as a cult may add more. Looking at them as a product of a historical development in that particular region, very recent post-2003 development.
Laura Beth Nielsen, we just have a minute left, but we just used two words. Cult certainly is something that we don't necessarily always associate with terrorism. But I guess I'm wondering if you could pick up on that thought a little bit. There are other actors, other types of definitions that maybe we haven't gotten to yet.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And the questions of the structural conditions that create groups who are willing to make demands in these violent ways is really important for us to understand, and the role of recruiting people who are perhaps mentally ill or close to being mentally ill. And we can't just rely on, did they see a psychiatrist at some point, you know, or a psychologist at some point before, because it's mental illness is incredibly undertreated and misunderstood. And so only the backwards looking trying to put it together is not going to work. We have to continue to research who are the people that join these groups, what are the conditions that create groups like this that are people are willing to join, how do they become radicalized. We have to continue to study in this area.
Laura Beth Nielsen from Northwestern University, thank you so much for your time today. I also want to thank Timur Yuskayev from Hartford Seminary, Vesna Markovic from the University of New Haven. Continue this conversation at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live.